Hello and welcome to Auntie Monkey. I'm Andrew Robertson and this is the sixth episode in the Ballooning podcast. So it seems that people keep listening to these podcasts, so we're going to continue generating content for you and hopefully you continue to enjoy it. So today we're going to get a little bit nerdy and we're going to take a look at technology and ballooning. Not so much the technology of balloons themselves, but more the technology that pilots and crew are using in the basket and on the ground. And we also are going to take a look at some of the innovations that we see are coming in the sport. To do this, I'm joined by another fellow ballooning nerd in the way of Sean Kavanagh. And for those who don't know Sean, he's an Australian-based ballooning manufacturer and an accomplished competition pilot that has been spending the last few years developing some really interesting software to help balloon pilots in their flying. And that software is called Aussie Target. And short of sounding like an infomercial, this is some software that I've personally been using for many years in my competition flying. And what it does is that it acts as an extension to the very popular moving map software called Aussie Explorer. And it gives balloon pilots the tools they need to plan out their flights in the way of drawing things like the wind data and flight data on the maps, allowing competition pilots to draw rings around targets and intersections, but really giving the tools to allow you while you're flying to get a really good snapshot of what's going on and to help you get closer to those targets as well as getting closer to those desired landing spots. Anyway, today's podcast, Sean and I go into a lot of detail about all sorts of different technology, and I have included in the show notes on auntiemonkey.com some detail about where to find more information about some of these things. Anyway, please enjoy listening to two geeks sitting around having some beers and chatting about technology. Well, welcome, Sean, to the podcast. This is our first experiment of doing an in-person one over a couple of beers. So hopefully it works out all right. We've got new technology, so it would be quite ironic if our discussion today about technology doesn't work because our technology fails.
All I can say is it's worth doing it in person just for the beer.
Oh, there you go. So it's a Friday afternoon at the end of a long week, so bear with us if we start losing our minds. It's been a long week, I think, for everybody. Excellent. So today we are going to dive into technology and technology and ballooning. But before we do that, maybe Sean, if you want to give us a bit of a introduction to yourself and how, firstly, you got into ballooning. You've been doing it for a while and some of the things you've done over the years in the sport.
Oh my goodness, where to start? I suppose a bit like yourself, I've obviously grown up in the sport with my parents running Kavanagh balloons and manufacturing balloons forever now, and came back into it, I suppose, about 91. By 91, I was crewing with my dad at the Worlds in Canada, in St. John's Richelieu, and having a bit of a blow up at my old man for not doing well enough. And, he said, well, you think you can do it? Go and get your license and do it. So that was what got me motivated to finally get my license, get flying about 93. Did my first nationals in 94 and qualified for Worlds in 95 and haven't looked back.
And you've also done a lot of, you've done commercial flying, instructional flying.
Yeah, so originally I was an aircraft maintenance engineer with Qantas, did my apprenticeship there. And after I finished up there, ended up on a tour with a 120, got my commercial license, started touring around Australia, working with that, and then flying passenger balloons over Melbourne. And during that time was doing design work for Kavanagh balloons on the side, engineering work and artwork and things, and got the phone call saying, hey, there's a business here, you better come back to it so I can retire. And that was like 15 years ago and he still hasn't retired.
And I think, as mentioned earlier, we're going to start talking about technology. You've also had a stint of being a computer nerd in the middle of that.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. When I was doing my apprenticeship at Qantas, I was also working on computer graphics on the side, and I sort of slipped into video production work and then live speaker support work at conferences and things like that. So that business was running on the side, and then about 1997 or something, I left Qantas to do that full time. But probably after going full time as a 3D animator and stuff like that, I realised I was going to become quite nocturnal, eating pizza and drinking Coke at unreasonable hours of the morning, rendering 3D animations, and then got an offer to fly balloons. But yeah, let's go in that direction.
It's amazing how ballooning always takes over our lives, isn't it?
Yeah, we seem to not be able to get away from it.
And now you're sitting in a ballooning factory, sitting behind a computer, eating pizza and...
Drinking Coke
and doing the same thing.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, it seems once you've got computer skills, that's it.
And then one of the other... The reason I've got you here to talk about technology and ballooning is that you've also, over the last few years, been developing what's known as Aussie Target. In some of our previous podcasts, people have made reference to it. Can you maybe just give a bit of background of what the history of Aussie Target is?
I suppose we could even go back a step earlier with GPS and things like that. I was a little bit late to the game playing with GPS, basically because I couldn't afford it. So obviously I started competing around that 93-94 period, where GPS was really just kicking in, and I couldn't afford a GPS until about 97. And we have a rather, it's a good sort of family rule, but if you want something, you figure out how to save up and buy it. You don't just get it. So I've had to make my own balloons and I had to buy my own GPS. And so I spent a lot of time flying and competing without GPS. And then around the time I was on this balloon tour in 97-98, Aussie Explorer first came out and I started playing with that. And back then didn't have access to scanned maps. You didn't have Google Maps or Google Earth or anything like that. So my first experience of moving map was a blank white screen with red dots going across it after a week of getting a GPS to actually connect to a laptop. And of course laptops back then were probably, a 286 processor with about 15 minutes of battery life.
Yeah.
So it wasn't set up for flying at all. But the thing I very quickly realized was that the software didn't do the things I needed it to do. And I talked to the developer of Aussie Explorer and I said, look, I'd really like to be able to draw multiple rings around waypoints and things like that to do the normal task plotting that we do on paper maps. And he said, well, there's an API, so you can write your own extensions or software to get Aussie Explorer to do the things you want. And I said, well, I don't know how to program. And he said, well, you better go and learn. And I think that's when I rang you up and I said, you know a bit more about programming than me. What do you reckon we do? And from there started learning Visual Basic.
Well, I think I was the one that had dodgy CDs of dodgy copies of software that I could lend you to start playing around with as well.
I don't know anything about that.
Neither do I.
But that was where it started. I mean, someone said, look, here's the idea, here's some example code. And it went from there. And I think as with most things in my life, if there's a seed for an idea, it's the mission then is to figure out how to do it. And so learning to program was a natural extension, I suppose, of the other computer skills I already had.
I guess one of the things is where you and I are obviously computer nerds and this stuff comes very natural to us. But I know there's still a lot of skeptics out there or people who are purists that don't necessarily want to have technology in the basket other than maybe a radio or maybe a GPS. What would you be sort of saying to people that maybe are interested in getting into having some basic technology? What's a good way to start?
Well, I think the first thing is maybe changing your mindset a little bit, that not to fear the technology. I mean, my whole approach with this has been, how can I use the technology to enable me to fly or concentrate on my flying more? So I suppose as a as a first step, the whole reason I went to moving maps and writing software like AussieTarget was that for anyone who's come from doing competitions on maps and with GPSs in the past, like paper maps, you would know that you spend a hell of a lot of time in the basket trying to figure out where you are relative to PZs, gridding intersections, recalculating fly-ons and everything else. And it takes a long time and it's a massive distraction. Mm-hmm. So my approach with the technology was, how can I speed this process up so that I spend more time flying the balloon? And so I think for most people, if you approach it from that angle and you start really simple, I mean, there's apps for your phone like Hot Air and a few others, and there's, you know, various mapping programs on, you know, you can run on iPads or Android tablets and things like that. And just start with a finger on the map so that you know where you are.
And that's certainly, even in competition, that's where a lot of people are simply using it, is that finger on the map. They're not necessarily using it for more detailed planning or, you know, as you said before, drawing rings on things. It's just taking that mindset off keeping an idea of where you are at a glance rather than actually having to sit there drawing with pens and pencils and, you know, on your laminated map, on your big map board that takes up half the basket.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's the trick, is to start really simple. Obviously, when you're introducing new tools into the basket, you want to be familiar enough with them so that it doesn't interfere with your flying. The sort of distracted flying that we've seen with maps and things over the years certainly kicked in with GPS, where people stare at their GPS. And a rather amusing story, actually, from early in my flying career. We had a competition at Canoundra at Marty's, and a fly-in task in the afternoon, and I, you know, greased in, did really well on the field, and won one of the major prizes. And I had a pilot coming up to me holding his GPS in his hand. He said, What bearing did you have? I'm going, I don't know. He goes, what do you mean you don't know? I said, I don't have a GPS. Like, it was just right there in front of me. He goes, but how did you find that wind? I was like, well, you know, if I went up, I went too far left. If I came down, I went too far right. And I just stuck it in the middle, you know.
So he was trying to shake his GPS and see what fell out and give him the right numbers.
Yeah, exactly. And so focused on the numbers that it wasn't working. So I think with any technology, you've got to be disciplined enough to step back. And, you know, if you've got a computer that crashes, hit the reset button and concentrate on flying. Don't stare at the computer waiting for it to boot up and freak out because it's not giving you numbers. Go back to flying the balloon.
Yeah. And for not necessarily competition, but in private flying, how do you generally use your technology if you're just going for a jolly with friends?
Depends on how well I know the area. So if I'm in an area that's not hugely familiar, then I will approach it exactly the same way as I would a competition flight. I mean, obviously a little bit more relaxed because I'm not setting multiple tasks and all that sort of stuff. But you know, I'll look at the map and do my flight planning on the computer, so I've got an idea of where I'm going, and I can tell my crew before I even take off what I think I'm going to do on that flight. I suppose the thing that I've got out of competition flying is that whether I'm flying commercially or I'm flying privately, having that planning mindset makes every flight so much easier. Mm-hmm. It freaks me out, the idea of just taking off and not knowing where I'm going to go, and, you know, let's just dawdle along and see what comes up. I mean, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, well, it's easier to look at your blue line on your Aussie and at least know where you've, which directions you've had and where you're headed.
Yeah, and also if it's changing, you know, if it's not working out the way you thought it was before you took off, then, you know, you can be a little bit more aware of it. You know, let your crew know 20 minutes earlier that they're going to have to cross the river or whatever. So,
and when you start competition flying, how would you start as your sort of first step?
I think the first skills you need to master, and I suppose my take on this is based around Aussie Explorer and AussieTarget. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously the tools that I work with all the time. I mean, the first thing is to get familiar with starting the software, getting your GPS to connect up and stuff like that. It sounds really silly, but file management, you know, is one of those really boring things, and it's probably the things that most computer users struggle with. But knowing where it saves the waypoints and your map files and things like that. So get familiar with all that stuff straight off the bat. When it comes to flying, start really simple. Start with the finger on the map, know how to select a waypoint and navigate to it. And go from there. The next thing that that you probably want to do is start playing with drawing wind lines and being able to plot the wind data that you're given in a flight so that you can start your flight planning and drawing circles. I mean, I think the way you would approach learning this is the way I started with the software. The first question was, how do I draw rings? The next one was, how do I draw my pieball data?
So when you're talking about rings, you're talking about when they give you things like minimum, maximum distances from the targets and things like that.
Yeah. And ideally, your approach to using the digital map is exactly what you would do on the paper map. And so they're the questions that I ask straight away is, how can I do on the digital map what I do on the paper map? And I'd suggest if you're learning it, you start with that too. You know, what's the first thing you do with your paper map when you're planning a flight? Okay, learn to do that on a digital map and go from there.
I know one of the points that you made very early on during one of our training sessions we did at Canoundra on competition flying about technology was, don't think that the technology is the secret weapon.
Yes, oh, definitely. It's quite amusing, you know, a lot of people flying with GoPros and things like that, and I watch video of myself flying, and I'm astounded at how little I look at the computer. And what I find is that the computer, I mean, it's probably the third time I've said it, but I use it for planning the flight. I use it for doing the calculations that I need to do a competition flight with. And then once you're flying, unless you're picking fly-ons or setting tasks mid-flight, it's really just a check to see that you're on track and you're not going to fly through a PZ. That's the main purpose of it. Yeah.
Where do you see that technology is going to take ballooning? Because we've gone through this progression of, you know, in the early days it was map and compass, then we suddenly got radios in the basket, which made the world a lot easier. Then we've moved into GPS, then laptops, Aussie Explorer, Aussie Target type technology. What's the future of technology in the balloon basket?
Ooh, it's a bit of a Raymond Kurzweil question. look, I think the main thing, or at least my focus, is integrating the different services or the different tools. And the problem we've got at the moment is that most of the software we're using hasn't been designed specifically for ballooning. We're lucky that with Aussie Explorer, you can extend that tool and get it to do the things we want it to do. But there's still features like tracking, reporting data back to your crew or a team manager and stuff like that that aren't natural extensions of any of this software that we're using. So developing those features is probably the next thing. The hardest part is, I suppose, working out how to visualize that data in a really useful way. You know, we're now at the point, even with Aussie Target, where, you know, you're collecting a lot of information while you're flying and you've got your flight winds that it's recording as you fly along. But turning that into useful information for doing the sort of calculations that will help you is probably the hardest part. I mean, there's other tools that I'm working on, and part of the reason they haven't been released is that the user interface isn't friendly enough to for people to use without hours of understanding what's actually being processed in the background. So if I've learned anything in software design, it's that the UI is the hardest part.
Yeah.
Try to make that seamless. So.
So have you built yourself an autopilot yet?
Not exactly.
And if you had, you wouldn't tell anyone?
No, exactly.
I know in the rule book for competition There is already a, there's still a clause. Sorry about the dog in the background. Yes. I knew that she would be getting excited to see a gift. Yes, I know that there is a rule in the rule books that says that you can't have any sort of automated pilot technology in there. So I think that's...
Yeah, but I mean, there's without getting into getting the balloon to fly level for you, it's a bit pointless, I think, unless you're doing a duration record or something, but or a distance record. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of data to be mined, and data is king. So in ballooning, as it is in everything, so figuring out how to pull the important information out of that and use it is the next step.
And I was talking to Johnny Petron the other day on the previous podcast, and we're talking about the younger balloonists that are coming into, especially into competition, and how this stuff's all such second nature to them. So I can only imagine going forward, the next generation's really going to start pushing the boundaries of how this technology can be used.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I'm already seeing that from the questions I'm getting, you know, from the likes of Clement and others. You've only got to look at who's asking the difficult questions or asking for the difficult tools to see that it's all coming from the young guns.
And I know that we've talked over the years about things like Google Glass and having heads-up displays and all sorts of things that, as funny as it sounds, I'm sure in the next couple of years that sort of thing's going to start appearing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was really fortunate probably last year to have a demo of HoloLens with Microsoft. And was talking to one of the developers there, and I mean the idea of having a heads up display where you can visualize the winds beneath you and above you, and have that augmented reality of wind directions projected over what you're looking at for real, you know, having an arrow pointing at a target that's over the horizon, so that you can visually see where you're going. That sort of stuff absolutely is going to happen.
Yeah.
Whether or not I can make it happen is another. I'm a bit time poor.
Time poor and budget poor.
but you know, I mean, it will happen. I mean, this, you know, we're already carrying a supercomputer in our pockets, and it's not long before the heads up display will be there for us.
So talking about, you mentioned the supercomputer in our pocket, I guess technology wise, can you maybe describe the sort of technology that you're personally flying with, like what sort of computer, laptops, GPSs, what are the toys in the basket?
Well, really simple. I've got a Surface Pro 4 that I do all my navigation on. If I'm in a competition that's using the CIA logger, I use their logger for the GPS feed to the laptop so that my laptop's seeing the same information the scorers are seeing. If I'm not flying with a CIA logger, I've got a tiny little USB mouse that was, you know, probably $30 from China. And in fact, I've just bought an even smaller one. I bought two of them for like $6 each to give them a whirl. And that's it. I've got an old Garmin 60 CS that I use as my backup logger for events where you can have barometric GPS as a backup. That's it. A couple of radios and, you know, basic fly tech instruments.
And I think that's something that I've certainly seen change over the years, is that I remember in the early days where you either had to buy a brand new, very expensive computer, or what we were doing, we're buying very cheap secondhand tablets and then essentially having car batteries in the bottom of the basket that we're plugging the computer in, because they wouldn't last more than an hour.
Yep.
So I think now it's a lot more accessible and everybody's running around with these laptops. So it certainly shouldn't be something that's, you know, your laptop and your GPS end up being in some cases cheaper than the radios that you're buying for the balloon.
Oh, not if you buy the little Baofengs.
Yeah.
Well, if you can afford ICOMs, then yeah.
certainly. So I think that's a key thing. I think from an accessibility point of view, it really is. If you've got a GPS and you've got a laptop, that's all you need to do. The software itself isn't particularly expensive, and it's really a case of just adopting it and starting to use it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, start simple, get out there, use it every day. I mean, we've had recurring conversations with various pilots in Australia who fly commercially every single day, and then they do, and they're getting into competition, and they're like, well, what do I do? And I was like, well, you're already ahead of the pack. You've got, you know, a training flight every morning to learn to use your computer. And amusingly, they don't do it. And then they seem to wait until 2 weeks before a competition to ring me up and say, oh, how do I actually do this? So just do it. Every time you go flying, just do it. So it becomes second nature.
So talking about Aussie Target, you obviously developed it originally for yourself as a tool or your secret weapon. How sophisticated did it get before you decided that you were going to release it, and why did you decide that you were going to release it to the public if it was your secret weapon?
It's an interesting story. I'm still questioning why I did that. I suppose I'd done most of the world championships between 95 and 2009. I think I'd missed one in there somewhere. And because I was chasing a girl instead of concentrating on the competition, but the nationals. So by the time I got to 2009 in Austria, I was ready to have a break and do something else. So, backed away, didn't do the next nationals, and just relaxed. And up until that point, I'd been using various, I suppose, versions of Aussie Target since probably 2002 or even 2000. I started flying with a laptop about 2000. So I had a break and then came to crew with you in 2012 in Battle Creek. And I can remember, you know, having been away from major competitions for about 3 years, turning up in Battle Creek and being absolutely mortified that, you know, out of 103 pilots, there was probably three or four that didn't have a map open, like a paper map on their desk. Everyone was still using paper maps in 2012. And you're sitting there with just a computer, and, you know, Matt's sitting there with a computer and a million questions.
Yeah. And sitting in first place at the time.
And sitting in first place and going, he does not deserve this. No, we have to edit that out.
No, we don't. There's a theme in this podcast that everyone has to bag out Matt Scaife.
Yeah. Yeah, Matt is the case for raw natural talent trumping hard work at every turn. No, so I was really surprised. I was really surprised to walk into those briefings in 2012 and see the number of people that had computers on their desk but weren't using them for their flight planning. And it was really became really obvious after talking to a few people, the reason they weren't using it for flight planning was that they were using, I suppose, the raw version of Aussie Explorer, which wasn't good for flight planning.
It could draw lines, but as you said before, no circles, which is a big part of competition flying.
Or multiple circles. So drawing minimum and maximum distances was impossible. You could draw a minimum distance or a maximum distance.
And then you put five targets on your map and suddenly you need to draw.
Yeah, and it's filling them all in blue and, it just wasn't set up for it. And I thought, wow, okay, something needs to change here. There's an opportunity. There's a potential market for this. And I did struggle with the idea of, I suppose, letting it go. But then I also, very quickly realised, probably again thanks to Matt showing me that raw talent trumps everything, that there was probably a lot to be gained from sharing it as well, that I'd get access to fresh ideas on how we could do this better. And I suppose a motivation to develop it, because it takes a lot of time. It's a lot of effort. I mean, if you're just doing it for yourself, then, in some ways you're limiting what you can do with it.
But certainly when you go to a briefing now, the majority of people now have laptops and their heads down in laptops, as opposed to, as you said, in 2012, where everyone was drawing and plotting on maps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pretty well since it's been released, the changeover, the acceleration in people using just computers for flight planning and everything has certainly increased. I think the other part that's, or the other thing that's played a part in that is that the technology's become better. I mean, laptops were notoriously rubbish for a really long time. And so it's taken a long time for battery life and screen brightness and all those things to get to a level that's useful. Because you know, like you said before, we were all flying around with gel cells and everything else to try and keep these things going for an entire flight. And now, you know, like a Surface Pro will run for the briefing, the flight, the post-flight, and you can probably nurse it through an afternoon flight as well.
Have you seen or are you hearing rumours of what people are doing around the world in terms of trying out new technology when it comes to competition?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Aussie Explorer and Aussie Target aren't the only solution out there. There's a couple of different bits of software. A lot of people previously have been flying on Motion X, on iPads and things like that. I know some people have been mucking around with ways of plotting descent paths and things like that, or descent predictions and marker drop predictions on with Motion X, and the other software has gone out of my head at the moment. There's a Swiss piece of software that seems to be geared towards team management of flying, and that will show you what your best left and right is, and if you start climbing now or descending now, where you'll end up. So those sort of tools are available everywhere, but again, you've got this problem that not one piece of software does everything. Aussie Target's working on a few of those things, and certainly there's a few of those things that I suppose the Australian team have got access to while we're beta testing them for the world. And if we get a world champion sometime, then we might release them to the rest of the world. but no, I mean, there's a lot of tools like that that are being worked on. Certainly the tracking thing is one of them. One of the problems at the moment, I suppose, is that like Motion X, for example, I think will let you track one other balloon, or you can have your position shared with your crew, or people are doing it with, you know, Glimpse or Where Am I Now and things like that on their phones. I suppose it's no secret that we certainly had tracking set up through Aussie Explorer and Aussie Target during the World Championships in Japan, which is fantastic because we're able to track all the balloons and crews and everything else, and the team manager, which was myself, was able to, you know, basically run it like a war room.
Well, you basically sat in your car for the whole week at the Worlds on your laptop and didn't get out.
Yeah, it's the warmest I've ever been in Japan. Very frustrating sitting in a car for the week, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, being able to coordinate what was happening from the ground and see where all, you know, where all the assets were on the map.
Are you calling us all assets? Did you really use that term?
I yeah.
I thought you were going to call us minions. I didn't expect assets.
My inner aircraft. Yeah.
Your nodes.
Yeah, there is nodes on the map. Yeah, but I mean, it was fun. I mean, it was really interesting to be able to see where everyone was, and just be able to see, okay, well, you know, this team's not going to have their crew at that target, so let's redeploy someone else and get them to cover that target.
A bit like being in the old war room, shuffling pieces on the big chessboard.
Yeah, that's all I needed was a stick to push little models of all of you around. But And I mean, you know, in the background, we're working on how do we take those services to more people, because obviously there was a big back-end effort in that. When I say back-end, you're shuffling data between balloons and cars and everything else. So how do you set that up so it works in every country? I mean, we're lucky in Japan. We could do it through GSM phones.
Yeah.
When we go to Europe, some of the European teams are doing exactly the same thing, but they've got to do it with radios and what they call TNCs, terminal node converters, to transmit data over radio because they don't have the GSM coverage. So while it's something that we're working on and we've got it working on one level, we don't have it working everywhere in the world. And that's one of the challenges.
And staying on the competition front, obviously competitions have changed over the last 10 years since the introduction of the loggers, less observer events, more reliance on the GPS loggers for scoring, not only for targets but also introduction of things like 3D shapes, etc. I can see that that's continuing to change. I know that the FAI and the CIA are getting, you know, various new technologies developed at this stage. Mm. How do you think that's going to be changing the way competitions work?
Well, that's probably a good podcast for you to follow up with with some of the technology team in the CIA. But I know from some of the discussions I've had, the logical next step is to link the logger to the flight computer that people are using. Because at the moment, again, we're talking about integration of the technologies. You have this crazy situation where you do all your flight planning on a computer now, but when it comes time to declare a goal or log a mark, you have to stop using the computer and then go up to the logger, start punching numbers on a tiny screen and a tiny keypad, which isn't friendly to use with gloves and all the rest of it. And hope you don't get it wrong. And it should just be a matter of pushing a button on the computer and saying send to logger,
yep,
declare goal. And I think it will go that way. I mean, the challenges, I suppose, that they've got is that they've got to have a system that's reliable. You know, there's probably 10% of the pilots, all statistics are made up on the spot, but that would be comfortable doing that through their computer.
Yep.
And then you'd have some percentage that would have a logger malfunction linked to them not using their computer properly. So there's a huge hurdle there in terms of making that link in the technology foolproof. And I hope that we can overcome it, but I think it's a little way off yet.
And I certainly know through all my nerdy analysis of competition results that the number of penalties that are logger marker related, like people declaring the wrong goals or pushing the wrong button, it's incredible. Like it is, other than flying in PZs, it seems to be the most common error that people are making. So obviously something needs to be addressed around that.
Yeah, well, I think, again, it comes down to familiarity. They don't use, like, people don't use the loggers all the time.
Yep.
And if you look at the pilots who don't make logger errors, they're probably flown more times with the loggers, so they're familiar with them. The people who are really serious have gone out and bought their own loggers so that they can train with it every time they go flying. I'm not quite that serious, but I mean, but there's an online tool that you can sit at home and practice with it so that you know how to use it. So again, the tools are there if you want to practice with it, and normally you'll get a practice flight or two before the event.
Well, it's almost the equivalent of the old days of practicing throwing markers. Now it's a case of practicing pushing buttons to make sure you get it right at the moment, because we certainly know when you're sitting above an intersection and that's your goal and you're trying to push buttons and throw markers at the same time, things go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think understanding, you know, latency in the system and differences in timing and understanding, you know, how to read that logger to get the best result, because it is a bit crazy, and I suppose it's one of my frustrations with logger-based competitions is that you now have a PDG that, you know, everyone flies through, and normally it would come down to how well you threw the marker. And now it's coming down to who got the timing right on pushing the button.
Mm-hmm.
Because invariably, like our last nationals, you know, you come back from a flight and everyone had a 6 meter result on that PDG or that fly on, according to their logger, until it gets scored. And then someone had 34 meters and 22 meters and 11 meters because they pushed the button at the wrong time.
Yep. Yeah.
And so I find that, I suppose, a disappointing aspect of the interaction with the loggers is that it's very easy to not get the result you thought you were going to get.
And in terms of GPS, what's your understanding of accuracy these days? I know certainly when we started competition flying with GPSs in the 90s, there was like anything better than 40 metres was doubtful.
Look, I think in most cases, it's generally within 5 meters most of the time. Yeah. I have to be honest, I haven't kept up to date with what's happening on that side of things. I just know it's good enough.
Yeah. Good enough.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, when you have chats with people like Gary Lockyer about scoring, and you get into the nitty gritty of rounding errors and resolution of maps and everything else. I mean, I go back to 95 in Battle Creek, and you were pacing across a field to the corner of a building, which was a black dot on a 1 to 50 thou map, and then measuring off the map, down to the intersection and all the rest of it.
Remembering your trigonometry.
And going, yeah, and exactly. And the observers punching it all out on a calculator and going, woohoo, you got 382 meters. And these days you just hit it with a GPS and it would probably still give you 382 meters.
In the future, what do you think that we can start using, or you're going to start seeing more on the launch sites?
A lot of teams now are using the wind sonde, as developed by the Swiss, as a replacement to the wind reader.
And for those who don't know, wind sonde, probably worth describing what it is.
So people are probably familiar or have seen the theodolites standing around on the edge of the field tracking pie balls, and they're hooked up to a computer and using software. And for tracking the pie balls and calculating speed and direction. What the wind sonde does is you actually launch the balloon with a radio package and a GPS. It also tracks temperature and humidity and all that sort of stuff. And it beams it back to a laptop. And so you get more accurate tracking information without having to stand around trying to drive a theodolite. The downside is that the sonde package is about $100 US, and during that flight you need to decide when to release it so that you can then go and retrieve it to use it again. So it gives you a lot of benefits in terms of much better data, but a slightly more technology-driven, complicated system and expensive system to run. So again, for the teams that are using multiples of these in a flight, you need to have a dedicated team basically running around, launching them, retrieving them.
Which is what we had, the Australian team had in Japan, was a van with two guys running around picking up these paper or foam cups out of rice paddies containing GPS trackers and things.
Yeah, and the Americans were doing it, and the Swiss do it, and the French are doing it, it's a lot of people are using it. I mean, it gives you a different set of challenges from a team perspective, but geez, it gives you good data.
I can definitely know that I've benefited from knowing what's happening at 8,000 feet from a wind song that you would never normally get from a theodolite or the data given to you from the weather briefings in competition briefings.
Yeah, absolutely. And that aspect of it, I mean, being able to get those readings before first light or through cloud, stuff like that. I mean, that's always been the limitation with a normal wind reading, that if you hit cloud base at 3,000 feet, you had no idea what was going on. And we've certainly seen examples where that's been really helpful to have the wind sonde early on when we were, one of the early teams using it. When you're the only one who knows what's happening above cloud base, very helpful.
For yourself, Sean, just on a personal note, what's the future for you in terms of your ballooning and your development of these new tools?
Well, having just qualified for the next World Championships in Austria, I suppose I better get back to the keyboard and start working on some new tools. I mean, for me, I need to get out and do more flying and start training for the next Worlds. I suppose I've just outed myself and said, yes, I'm going to take the spot.
That was the scoop. You all heard it here first. Sean is out of retirement again.
Yes. So... just don't call me Floyd. Hopefully this will be a $150 million payday or whatever it was. No, so, Yeah, getting ready for the next Worlds as a competitor rather than a team manager is the next thing on the cards. Obviously very busy with engineering projects at work, but in terms of software, yeah, I mean, we've got to sit down and still work out what direction we want to take things, figure out what to share with the world before the next Worlds. And knock the edges off some of the new tools so that we can release them to other people and use them ourselves.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We'll get you back to talk about some of your other ballooning adventures that you've done over the years and even maybe talk about how some of the actual balloon technology works rather than the computers and things in the baskets. So thank you for joining us today, Sean.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me, and thanks for the beer.
Hi, it's Andrew here again. Just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to Auntie Monkey via the auntiemonkey.com website. We'll send out emails each time a new episode's made available. Plus, you can also subscribe via iTunes and your Android podcasting app. Please also remember to share Auntie Monkey on Facebook. We want to make sure we get the word out there and so everybody in ballooning can enjoy the podcast. Thanks, and see you next episode.